Scaredy Cats. I still remember when I found out that Santa wasn't real. I'm going to peel back the curtain a little bit here and admit one of my probably most embarrassing secrets. I was in grade 7, standing in line for French class, and a bunch of my classmates were making fun of me for believing in Santa. Because generally, by the age of 11, you know the truth, but not me. Whether I was just incredibly naive or my parents were just really good liars, or a bit of both, I still believed. To this day, one of my favorite teachers of all time was that French teacher, Mr. Icasella, because he came out of the classroom, overheard what was happening, and said that he still believed in Santa Claus. I knew then that he was just trying to make me feel better, but it did mean a lot. The illusion may have been destroyed, but I didn't become a Christmas-obsessed and homicidal Santa. The same can't be said for the main character in the 1980 film Christmas Evil, which incidentally is John Waters' favorite Christmas movie.
He'd be happy that we remembered him.
This Christmas, Santa's going to make everyone happy. The grown-ups. And the kids. Christmas Evil. The non-believers.
Watch out!
And the screamers. This Christmas, you better believe in Santa, or he'll slay you.
Merry Christmas, Frank.
Christmas Evil, the night he dropped in.
I'm your host, Sherry. This is just your friendly reminder that, as always, there will be loads of spoilers. So if you haven't seen the movie, go watch it. Otherwise, proceed at your own risk. Joining us today is Ariel. Hi, how are you today?
Hi, I'm doing good, but I'm rocked with this new information. Santa's not real?
Oh, I ruined it for someone. Oh, no.
Now I'm going to have to become a weird toy maker and treat every day like I'm on the edge of Christmas.
No.
I guess that's just what happens.
And then we're going to have a repeat of the end of this movie. You're going to find me and like it's all your fault, Sherry.
As long as I get to drive off into the sky.
Right? Exactly. So why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself? This is your first time on the show.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's really great to be here. You can find me on different corners of the internet just talking about horror all day long. I mostly write for Ghouls Magazine, which is a UK-based website that celebrates horror through a female perspective. So we do reviews and interviews and editorials and analyses and all kinds of things. And I'm their admin assistant, but I also write for them. And I write for a few other horror sites, including Moving Pictures Film Club. And I am kind of a podcast tourist. I love to go around to different horror podcasts and just kind of pop in wherever. So I thank you so much for inviting me on here so I can just kind of do my favorite thing, which is just talk about horror to everybody.
Oh, I love it. And I've never heard somebody call themselves a podcast tourist before, but that's my new favorite phrase. I love it. That's great.
Well, I don't travel very frequently. So this is my tourism.
I like it. That's great. So we're going to subject you to where I hate when I do that all the time and use the royal we. I'm going to subject you to the Scaredy Cat 5. So these are just 5 questions that we ask new guests to kind of get an idea of what they like in horror, what their history with horror is, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
I'm so ready.
I know some of these questions are really hard. And if somebody asked me these questions, I'd be like, I don't know. Why are you asking me this? But I guess that's the benefit of being the host.
Exactly.
To kick it off, what's your favorite subgenre of horror?
Yeah, well, it depends on the day that you ask me, but it's usually between found footage or the ever maligned torture porn.
Oh, really?
Yeah, no one ever gives that answer.
No,
right?
They don't. They really don't. In fact, I used to ask what your least favorite subgenre of horror was. And I actually took it out because I was like, that's just mean-spirited and nobody needs to hear that. But that was often the reply, was like people said torture porn.
I am out here like representing it for all the fans who are too shy to say it.
And I think that might be it. I think people might be like, ooh, like if I say torture porn, people are going to be like, oh, you're that kind of person. But like,
well, exactly.
There's some great, great movies that fit into that subgenre.
Yes. And it is interesting, right? Because it is a subgenre of horror that even horror fans look down on. You know, if you say like, I like zombie movies. No horror fan out there is like, whoa, zombie movies. Like, that's weird. We can't talk anymore, you know. But if you say, and part of it is the words torture porn, those are unpleasant words to put together, right? Yep. But even if you sort of talk around it and describe what you mean, that is, I was talking on another podcast recently about this topic, and like, how many times have you heard the exact phrase like, oh yeah, I'm into horror, but not all that torture porn stuff?
All the time.
It's like it's like a stock phrase you can pull out if you're a horror fan meeting other horror fans. And so I want everybody to like what they like. I don't want to get down on anybody for not liking the same thing as me. I just do like to say out loud that in the 2000s, there are some nasty, grimy movies that are really fun for me, and we're celebrating an important part of horror history, so I like to shout them out.
I like that. And I feel like found footage also sometimes gets a bad rap, right? Like, some people are like, oh, I can't stand found footage movies.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we could do a whole podcast episode about that, but I won't subject you to that. I do think that found footage is one where there's such a variety of like quality, you know, there's really excellent scary found footage, and then there's found footage that you're like, I could have made this, and it is not a compliment to me to say that.
Yeah. Yes, and for sure.
Yeah. So I do think, like, if you're out there just kind of combing through whatever you can find, you're going to land on a lot of examples that aren't the best. But for me, there's nothing scarier than a well-done scare in a found footage movie, because it feels like you're seeing something you're not supposed to see.
Mm-hmm. It feels very immersive as well, right? Like, you feel, yeah. And you're right. Like, there are some found footage movies that I watch and I'm like, oh my gosh, this person had very little budget, which is why a lot of people are attracted to found footage. And this just movie didn't work. But then you see other movies where you're like, I know you picked found footage because you had a very low budget, but what a cool idea, and what a great execution of that idea.
Yeah.
What's your favorite horror movie?
So this is an easy answer for me. So this is The Blair Witch Project.
Great choice.
Speaking of really well done, low budget found footage.
Yeah. It's funny that you say that. We covered this, I think, in the first year of the podcast. And the Blair Witch was one of those movies that I watched once in the theater. Mm-hmm. And it scared me so much that I did not watch it again until I was covering it for the podcast.
Yeah.
And because it's terrifying.
It's so scary.
And it's, like you said, perfectly – you feel like you're watching something that you shouldn't be seeing, and you are just sucked right in, and you are there with Heather and Mike, and I can't remember the other guy's name.
Josh,
thank you.
Yeah, what can I say about The Blair Witch Project that hasn't been said, you know? I mean, it's my favorite movie, but I haven't watched it very many times compared to some other movies I'll just like throw on in the background. When I watch The Blair Witch Project, it's an event. And like, I put my phone away, I turn the lights off, I turn the sound up, and I really just like go for the full immersive experience as much as I can. So when I do that, it's a real treat, and it has never really lost its impact on me. And that's really special. Yeah.
Yeah. I feel like I need to watch it with headphones one day. That's one thing I haven't done. Turn off the lights, watch it with headphones. I think that would up the ante for me as well.
You know, I've never done that either, and I think that's an awesome idea.
Yeah, it's funny. One of my friends suggested doing that with Hereditary. He's like, watch Hereditary, like,
God.
And headphones on. And since then, that's always my, should I watch this with headphones? Because there's so many little things that you're going to pick up that you don't pick up necessarily when you're watching it with just surround sound or whatever.
That is very true. There are some movies that are a lot scarier with headphones on. The Exorcist is one that I think of. Oh boy.
What is the first horror movie you remember seeing?
So I'm pretty sure it was the It miniseries, Stephen King's It miniseries from, I think, 1990.
Nice. With John Ritter.
Is he? Yes.
Yeah.
I was like, see, I just think of Tim Curry. But yeah, I mean, lots of good ones in that cast. And for whatever reason, like, I didn't grow up in a household where I was like allowed to watch whatever I wanted, but also my parents were pretty open-minded with things, so I did eventually like see a good amount of scary movies when I was younger. But the Stephen King different miniseries that came out, like It and The Stand and Salem's Lot, etc., Storm of the Century, you know, because they were made for TV, they automatically had this like toned down level of right. sex and violence, and they were still very scary because I don't know how you make Pennywise the Clown not scary. Well, I do know how you do it, actually. It's at the end of It Part 2, but never mind. We won't go there. I don't know how you make Tim Curry's It not scary. So anyway, I was allowed to watch those, and like there's a scene where he's like, It reminds me of Halloween, actually, where Pennywise is like standing in some laundry and the sheets are blowing and he's waving. Mm-hmm. And I just remember seeing that as a really little kid and being like, oh, God, this is fear. And it's awesome.
Nice.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I remember watching that miniseries when it came out and just being like blown away. Oddly enough, I'm a huge Stephen King fan. Salem's Lot is my favorite book by Stephen King. I did not watch that miniseries until last weekend when I watched it for the first time.
What did you think?
2 weeks ago. I loved it.
Nice.
I thought it was great. Yeah. Yeah. I can see like I had some issues with the pacing a little bit, but overall I thought it was really good.
I think that those miniseries all have some pacing problems because they had to fit certain TV slots, you know? But yeah, the Salem's Lot is a classic.
Who is your ultimate final girl?
So this is probably the toughest question on the list that you sent me, at least for me. I always want to say Sydney Prescott, but then I don't want to like just be that basic, you know? But like, how do you beat Sydney Prescott? So I was trying to think about it more. And maybe it's just the time of year, but I was like, okay, I'm going to say Jess from the original Black Christmas.
Oh, excellent choice.
Yeah.
That's one of my all-time favorite horror movies.
It's amazing. Mm-hmm. It is just an absolutely perfect slasher. It's really emotional. It's really surprising and progressive. Mm-hmm. And all of the characters feel like real people, I mean, as much as they can in a movie, and they feel like friends that you might really have. Yes. And Jess is someone who I would want her to be my friend. She's just take charge, take no bullshit, but in a way that feels very true. Like sometimes at the end of a slasher, when a final girl is like picking up the weapon and, you know, killing the killer, I'm like, okay, yeah, that's great in a movie, but like I can't really see myself or that character doing that. But Jess takes charge in ways that are realistic, like being really assertive on the phone with the police and like strategically hiding when she should hide and fighting when she should fight, not running toward danger, but trying to protect herself, but being there when danger is there for her. Like, I think Jess is just awesome.
Yeah. And that scene where she's screaming for Barb and Phil because she's learned that the killer's in the house, or the call's coming from inside the house, I guess. That scene is just she's just perfect in that scene.
Yeah.
Okay, so if you have not seen Black Christmas, listeners, I suggest you skip ahead 30 seconds-ish because I'm going to ask a spoilerish question. Do you think that Jess survives the end?
No, I don't.
Yeah. I like to pretend she does, but I don't think she does either.
Yeah, I would like to pretend to as well, but if she survived the end, then I think we wouldn't get the phone ringing at the end, you know?
All right, well, how long would you last in a horror movie?
I don't know. I feel like I'd be dead instantly. I don't know. I mean, like, I want to give a cooler answer. But I also feel like, okay, here's a truth about me. I investigate the strange noise. Like, that's just who I am. That's me as a person. I will go up into the attic, down into the basement. I will open the front door and I will investigate the strange noise. And I think part of that comes from a job I used to have where I was in charge of some housing for other people. And so the people living in the housing, like, their safety was partly my responsibility. And so I couldn't just, like, lock myself in my apartment and just hope for the best. Like, it was partly my responsibility. And even though I haven't done that job in a long time, I'm still sort of like in that mindset of like, oh, I can't just let something be. So I feel like I would be the opening kill, or maybe like the second kill, where someone before we know there's trouble, right? Before we've established there's a killer, I go to investigate the strange noise, and then I'm just Casey Beckard.
Oh. You know, it's funny that you say that, because I always say it would depend on the horror movie. I've actually since come to a new conclusion, but it would depend on the horror movie, because if it were a ghost story, I feel like I would survive. Like a slasher, okay. No way. However, I was editing. I've been doing Christmas ghost stories leading up to Christmas. So we're releasing one episode a day where I'm reading a Christmas ghost story. And on this Christmas ghost story episode, I'm editing it. And I hear in the background, my headphones are on, nobody else is home. I hear, here.
Stop it. No.
And I was like, now my cats like to make weird noises in the background. You can actually probably hear one of them right now, like caterwauling. So I'm like, was that one of the cats, or did I like swish something against the desk? Like, I always say, if I were haunted, I would know right away and I'd be like, burn that place down, I'm out. But now, like, here I am a week later and still in the haunted microphone house, and I don't know. So,
we'll Sherry, this episode has now become an intervention. We need to get you out of there. You're literally reading a ghost story and somebody whispers the word here.
Yeah, yeah,
no. Nope. This cancel everything. We need to get you and the cats out of there. That's really scary.
Yeah. Yeah, it's weird. I always, and it probably was something that happened. I think no one was home, but maybe my partner was home and I don't remember. And he thought he was being funny.
No, you know.
Yeah. Oh, man. Well, if I end up possessed, or, you know, I don't know. How do ghosts usually kill people? Just out of fear. If I die of fright, people will know.
We'll all know what happened. You heard it here first, folks.
Exactly. Hopefully I get to edit this and people will know the truth if that happens.
But. God, I should have hit record. It's too late. We'll just have to see what happens.
Exactly. Just avenge me on Twitter if that happens.
Okay, sure.
Okay, perfect. So the letterbox summary for Christmas Evil is: a toy factory worker, mentally scarred as a child upon learning Santa Claus is not real, suffers a nervous breakdown after being belittled at work and embarks on a Yuletide killing spree. It's a pretty accurate description, I think.
Yeah, that is technically true. That does not – if you just read that description of the movie, this movie could be so many different things. And it ends up being none of those things that you thought it would be.
100%. Yeah, yeah. So do you remember the first time you saw Christmas Evil?
I kind of do. It was pretty recently. It was so on Shudder, Joe Bob Briggs will do these events sometimes. I don't know if you're familiar. He's a horror. Yeah, you're familiar.
Yeah.
So he does these holiday specials sometimes, and I don't remember if it was last year or 2 years ago or when it was, but one of the years he did Christmas Evil, and I watched it then, and I remembered it being a lot like like, I'm not going to be negative on this movie or anything, but just when I rewatched it to record this episode, I was like, what is this? Like, how did I forget how strange this is? But the format of the Joe Bob Briggs show is that he'll, like, interrupt the movie and get, like, give you information and do the horror host thing. So, like, right. That can make a movie feel really different. Also, I was probably drunk. So, like, that probably added something. So that's why I say I kind of remember the first time I saw this movie. But what about you? When did you see this?
So I saw it a couple of years ago. Brian from Movies for Life, the podcast, I'd been saying something about, like, looking for a new Christmas horror movie to watch, any recommendations, and on Twitter, and he recommended it. And okay. I watched it and was like, huh, that was not what I expected it to be at all.
Right.
Like, I thought it was going to be more like, oh my goodness, what's the name of the movie?
Silent Night, Deadly Night.
Thank you. That's it. Yeah. Silent Night, Deadly Night. I thought it was going to be more like that. But it's much more complex, I feel like, than that. And I actually went back on Letterboxd and looked at my rating, and I think I'd rated it 3.5 stars. And I don't normally rate movies, so I don't know why I decided to rate it, but I did. And I've now watched it. I watched it last year as well at Christmas, and then I've now watched it 4 times this season.
Okay.
And I think I like it more and more every time I see it.
You know, I could see that being true for this movie because it is so different than I think what we are set up to expect, or maybe the expectations we put on it. But it is so, everybody says it's so different than what they expect. Mm-hmm. That maybe once you've seen it and you know what's coming, maybe that is like a richer experience.
Maybe. Yeah. Yeah, that's a good point. You're expecting a really campy slasher movie.
Yes.
You don't get it. So you're kind of like, huh, that's not what I thought this was going to be. So that might impact how you view it. And then the next time you see it, you're like, oh no, I know what I'm watching going in. And it's more of a character study. Yeah.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you this. As I was watching this movie this time, I was thinking, like, I wonder if they meant to make it I wonder if they meant to make a different movie. Like,
I was going to ask you the same thing.
Okay. Yeah. Because, like, the idea of a little boy experiences some trauma on Christmas Eve and grows up to have really complicated, intense feelings about Christmas and eventually, like, becomes a Santa spree killer. Like, give that story to Ari Aster and, like, we're talking about a completely different vibe. Like, it feels like almost like they wanted to make a serious case study of a person. And then it was just like, it's not silly enough to be like a comedy horror. And it's not really like scary or gory enough. Like, the body count's pretty low, I think.
Yeah.
So I'm just kind of like, were they trying to make a drama and it didn't work out? And so they just dumped it into the horror category. I don't know.
I suspect kind of because – so it was written and directed by Lewis Jackson, and he has actually said that he considers the movie less a slasher and more like a classic monster movie like Frankenstein, which I think maybe leads me to believe that, yeah, they didn't intend to make it as a slasher movie, like a campy slasher, and that it was supposed to be more dramatic than that. So,
yeah. I almost want that, you know, like I want to see a different version of this same story because there's some things that happen throughout and some lines that are delivered throughout that make me feel like what's going on under the surface? Like, did something get cut from the story or like, what if we explored that more? And I can't believe I'm like saying this, but like, I'm like, give me a longer, more intense version of Christmas Evil, please. Apparently I'll watch it.
I love that. All right. Well, let's talk a little bit about the making of the movie. So there's not really a lot of information about it. It was obviously a fairly low budget movie. I think actually the budget was $850,000, which I guess in 1980 wasn't terrible. It stars Brandon Maggart, who is actually Fiona Apple's dad.
Oh.
Yeah, if listeners know who Fiona Apple is.
I do.
It was released on November 7th, 1980 and had the working title Santa, but then was originally titled You Better Watch Out, also known as Terror in Toyland. So went through a few different names before they landed on Christmas Evil. Again, I don't think any of those names would lead you to believe that this is going to be a slasher again.
Yeah, it's just like, got that. All of them have like sort of a similar vibe of like mm-hmm. an 80s slasher.
Yes. Yeah. The toy factory featured in the movie was an actual toy factory that was owned by Lynn Pressman, who is the mother of executive producer Edward R. Pressman. Hmm. I could only find a couple of reviews, and they were more like retrospective reviews, both positive. One complimented the film's unique editing style, cinematography, music, and sense of humor. This was All Movies saying, Christmas Evil is not for all tastes, but it's well worth the time for those looking for a darker, different kind of Yuletide film. And then Tom Huddleston from Time Out gave the film 4 out of 5 stars, saying, in contrast to most slasher flicks, this isn't about anything as simple as revenge. Jackson's concerns are bigger: social responsibility, personal morality, and the gaping gulf between society's stated aims at Christmas time, charity, hope, goodwill to all men, and the plight of those left on the outside, the children, the mentally ill, the ones who don't fit in. It's a great looking film too. One shot of a suburban street lined with glowing reindeer looks more like Spielbergian sci-fi than low budget horror. Bizarre, fascinating, thoughtful, and well worth a look.
I love that.
And that scene that he's talking about with the glowing reindeer, like lining the streets, that's a very pretty scene.
It is. Yes. I do agree that this movie is really well made. Yeah, there's a lot of like beautiful Christmas imagery. And then even just sort of like the interior scenes of the like domestic settings seem very realistic to me. And then there's that corporate party that he goes to, where they're talking about the charity, but they don't really care about the charity, but he really cares about the charity. Like, all of that to me works really well because they quickly and efficiently deliver you these themes and these ideas that the mm-hmm. review you were just reading touches on. But they do that really efficiently without like spending too much time on it. And we already know our main character and how he's going to feel about it at that point. So like, yeah, I mean, the movie, it all works and hangs together. Mm-hmm. I'm just like confused why it's not a slasher, but that's okay.
Yeah, it definitely comes across as even like when you look at it on Shudder, when you like open up the page on Shudder and it's on there and it looks like it's going to be something that it's not, I feel like.
Yeah.
All right, so we'll just go through a quick plot synopsis before we get into our other thoughts about the movie. So, on Christmas Eve 1947, we meet this young boy named Harry Stadling, and he's super excited to see Santa come down his chimney. And it's kind of a perfect setting. Like, it is very, like, it starts out as one movie, I feel like, where you've got milk and cookies laid out for Santa. You've got the tree sparkling with tinsel and ornaments, and Santa puts the presents under the tree and fills the kids' stockings. And the mother and the two brothers are sitting there watching all of this. But then the illusion is shattered when that night, while lying in bed, Harry's brother Phil tells him that Santa was just their dad dressed up. And Harry is very, very upset. He heads downstairs where he sees Mom getting cozy with Santa. I feel like he overreacts. I mean, maybe not. He heads up to the attic. Yeah. He smashes a snow globe. You agree he overreacts?
I should say.
Yeah. He smashes a snow globe. He cuts himself with a shard of glass. We then fast forward to Harry as an adult, and he sleeps in these silk Santa pajamas, and he wakes up and immediately, in fact, his alarm clock is this weird little carousel that plays Christmas music, and he gets up and then puts on more Christmas music to stretch and dance around his apartment too. And we really see how obsessed he is with Christmas, because we do this quick turnaround in his apartment and it is covered in like Christmas decorations. There's toys, like these dolls line the walls. And it's not quite Christmas yet. It's not even Thanksgiving yet. So mm-hmm. This is, do you think his apartment's like this year round?
I think it is, because one of the pieces of the set that I think is really clever is that there's a countdown to Christmas chalkboard in the background of his apartment. And I think the first time we see it, it says like 53 days or something like that.
Right. Yeah, that's true.
And the movie, I paid attention to this because I was like, are we going to see that again? Are they going to remember to change the number? And they do. Like, you see, it's not ever used as like the center point of a shot to tell you how close we are to Christmas, but you do see it in the background a few times and the number does go down. So to me, what that tells me is like, this is how he lives all the time, no matter how close to Christmas we are.
That's weird. That's weird. So Harry works as a supervisor at the Jolly Dreams Toy Factory, but he misses being on the line. So he used to be on the line in the factory making toys. And in his spare time, he spies on neighborhood kids and he keeps naughty and nice lists. The child that causes him perhaps the most distress is young Moss Garcia, who likes to look at Penthouse, leading him to what Harry records as impure thoughts and poor body hygiene.
Yeah.
Poor Moss. Like, he's just a kid. Come on.
He seems like a pretty regular kid.
He does. Yeah.
And like, there's a very, very gendered, I mean, of course there's going to be, but like when he's spying on the little girl who's like taking care of a baby doll and kissing mm-hmm. her baby doll, he writes down, like, he has these pros and cons lists of their behavior. And one of the things he writes for her is just a darling,
yes.
which isn't really anything.
No, no.
But then like he writes down that like one of the good boys is taking out the trash.
Yes.
And like, that is a tiny little encapsulation of like the way, you know, it's still now, but especially in earlier decades, like boys and girls were socialized to be, you know, active and passive, respectively. Mm-hmm. And so, like, we've got this girl sitting quietly kissing a baby doll versus a boy taking out the trash. Those are both good behaviors. And it just kind of blew my mind. I was like, whoa, like, they're saying it right here. Like, he's literally writing it down on a naughty nice list that these are the behaviors they want little girls and boys to do. And I was like, wow, someone could unpack that.
Yes, I never thought about that, but you're right, 100%. It's also interesting to me that he gets excited and is like, cheers on one of the kids who says he wants to become a fighter pilot so he can dive bomb the, like, or like blow up the projects. And I'm like, that's not something you should be encouraging. That child is going to be like a mess when he grows up.
That's very strange. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how Harry decides who's good and who's bad. And also, he probably shouldn't spy on children with a telescope.
No. Yeah. And I will say, the very first time I watched it and he's like leaning around, I think he's leaning around a corner and like looking at one of the kids. And I'm like, is this going to be like that kind of movie? Because
right.
I don't know if I can watch it, if that's what's going to happen. Not at all. Like, he doesn't have any, but you're right. He should not be doing those things.
Yeah. Like, I think it is, you know, other than being like very judgmental and like this weird Santa complex, it's very innocent. Like, he interacts with children several times throughout the movie, especially dressed as Santa, mm-hmm. and it all remains very above board. It's just like very, very strange if you know what's going on inside his head.
Yeah. And they love him. Like, all the children love him, with the exception of Moss Garcia, as we said. So Harry doesn't get along too well with his coworkers. He takes toy making very, very seriously, as he takes Christmas very seriously, but the others don't. In fact, one of his coworkers, Frank, expresses that Christmas is the time that he gets slaughtered. Little foreshadowing there. Buying presents, though, he says. So Frank gets Harry to cover his shift on the assembly line, ostensibly so that he can leave early for Thanksgiving. But after his shift, Harry finds out that Frank tricked him when he sees Frank drinking at a bar. So Harry is understandably not too happy with this. And when he gets home, he breaks one of his toys as he hums, "Santa Claus is coming to town."
Like, very aggressively.
Very aggressively. Yeah.
It's a weird scene. It's almost like I mean, I think what that scene is doing is he's trying to tamp down his anger and he can't. Like, he's singing a song that would soothe him. He's holding a toy, which is something he loves. And he still is like, has all this pent up anger that it can't help but come out as he's like crushing the toy and very angrily humming a Christmas song. So it's kind of like, oh my God, you get the sense that something has been building for quite a while.
He then proceeds to peep in his brother's window. And I think his brother lives in his family home, I think.
I think so.
And then he sees his brother playing with his kids before the kids go to bed, and Phil starts making out with his wife on the couch. So Harry is a little bit of a peeping Tom. Like, we often see him, like, watching people through windows, or, like, even at one point he is peering in on a Christmas party from outside and just very much, which I guess, you know, Santa Claus is always watching people, so it fits.
Yeah, and I think, like, whether or not he's done this to himself or it's a self-fulfilling prophecy or what, like, he's very othered, you know? Mm-hmm. Like, other than his brother and his brother's wife and their kids, he doesn't have any family. And we don't see him with any friends. He's definitely not popular at work. Yeah. So he probably has this feeling of being on the outside looking in, like, all the time in his life, like watching things that happen to other people. Other people get to do things and he doesn't get to do them. And I think that's why it's so magical later in the film, which I know we'll get to, when he's invited in as Santa Claus.
Right.
Like, he barely knows what to do with that invitation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The next day, Harry watches the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade before canceling dinner with Phil and his family. And we learn that Phil and Harry don't have the best relationship, but Jackie, Phil's wife, really tries to encourage him to be more patient and more kind with Harry. And just wants them to have a better relationship, really. Mm-hmm. So Harry begins to prepare for Christmas, and he's making his Santa suit with great care. Like, he is, you know, he pads the legs, and it's kind of a montage of him making this Santa suit. Mm-hmm. He picks this beautiful, like, dark fur that he uses, hopefully fake fur, but it was the 80s, so probably not.
Probably not.
He paints a sleigh on the side of his white van. He's reviewing the wish lists of the good kids. Like, he knows what they all want for Christmas. He kind of stalks Moss Garcia a little bit, and he makes toys in his creepy workshop. Like, that workshop is scary.
Yes.
It's time for the company Christmas party, and the owner of Jolly Dreams announces via video on the TV that the company, which also in 1980 would have been like the height of like technology.
Yeah.
He announces that the company will donate toys to the children of the local hospital, but he asks his employees to donate their own money and keep working hard to get those toys made. At this point, one of the executives of the company introduces Harry to a new up-and-comer, George, who is part of the executive training program. And Harry learns that George is the one that came up with this donation idea, but really it's a scam. The factory isn't really planning on donating too many toys. They're counting on their employees to donate. This is really more about the optics and, you know, looking charitable for Christmas.
Which I think is something like many of us could probably relate to, especially with workplaces and like giving campaigns around this time of year. I know that's something I've run into where it's kind of like, well, are we doing this because it looks good, or mm-hmm. who's really doing this, and who are we helping, or are we just doing it to get the like the PR? And I think it also has to do with like, if Christmas is magical to you when you're a little kid, Christmas can lose its magic as you get older and you realize that the magic of Christmas is just someone doing the work. And like, as you have to become the one to do the work to make your own Christmas magical, it can feel like a little bit of glass shattering. And so I think Harry's having these moments over and over again where he's like, but the magic of Christmas, you guys, and, and, you know, everybody else is just kind of, you know, a little bit either less into it or more cynical. And I think he's just having a hard time processing that.
Yes, for sure. So this infuriates Harry, and he leaves the Christmas party to go to the factory floor where he stuffs toys into sacks. And then on Christmas Eve, he glues this full white beard to his face and has this mental break And I think this is really where he starts to believe that he is, maybe he doesn't actually believe he's Santa Claus, but he believes he's doing the work of Santa Claus.
Yeah.
So what does Santa do on Christmas Eve? Well, he delivers toys to good young girls and boys. And instead of coal, he leaves bags of dirt to the bad kids like Moss Garcia.
Yes. That was a big bag of dirt, too. It was not like a tiny little sack. It was like a Santa sack, but just filled with dirt.
Yeah.
I was like, okay. It's expensive.
I feel like, you know, Harry's probably got like some good like arm strength because he's carrying around these bags of dirt and these big sacks of toys. And, like,
seriously. Yes. Hauling things all over the place. And he steals a bunch of toys.
Yes.
From, you know, the charity event. Because one of the things he asks at the work party charity event thing is, are there going to be enough toys for all the kids at the hospital?
Right.
And the person who answers him is kind of like, I don't know. Like, what kind of a question is that? You know, like, just sort of like very taken aback by the question at all. And Harry can't stand the idea that, like, maybe some children will get toys and others wouldn't. And so he goes on this vigilante mission to take these stolen toys he's stealing from his workplace and take them to the hospital himself, which I think is one of the greatest parts in the movie.
Oh, it's fantastic. So like you said, he proceeds to the children's hospital. He's at first greeted with suspicion by the security guard. Yeah. And you think that maybe things are going to start to go really wrong here.
Yeah.
But they don't. People that work at the hospital come out, they gather, they get all the toys, and everybody is just happy, like beaming. They're so excited. So this Harry as the hero here.
Mm-hmm.
But then his next stop is the church.
Yeah.
Where George and the other executive from the Christmas party are attending midnight mass. This is something I wasn't sure on. And I mean, we'll never know. Does he go there looking for George and this executive, or does he just happen to stumble upon them?
I don't know. Because
how does he know where they are?
Right, because it seems like he does go there knowing they're going to be there. Like, his determination and his creepy toy soldier thing sticking out of his bag make it seem like he knows exactly where he's going with a purpose. But I also don't know how he knew they were going to be there. Like, we don't hear a line at the Christmas party of like, oh, yeah, see you later at mass or anything like that.
Yeah, at this church. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly.
So I'm not really sure. I'm not sure if it was cut. I'm not sure if we're meant to know. Maybe it's the magic of Santa.
Oh, maybe. Maybe. The first folks out of the church are very snotty, yuppie types, and they mock Harry and his Santa Claus outfit, which leads Harry to slaughter them. First with a toy soldier eye gouging, which is brutal, and then using a hatchet. And these are the first deaths in the movie. So again, if you think you're going in to see a slasher, I think this happens almost at the hour mark.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, so that's a long way to wait for a kill in a slasher movie.
And this scene is so strange to me, too, like, because it's Christmas Eve, and, like, clearly these are people who celebrate Christmas, like, that has been established. So why would they walk out of a church on Christmas Eve, see a man in a Santa suit, and decide to ridicule him? Like, I don't know about you, but it's pretty normal for me to see people in Santa suits, like, going to and from their gigs.
Yeah.
In like around town, like it would not be weird to see a person in a Santa suit on Christmas Eve. And even if you did, it wouldn't be like, look at that weirdo, let's make fun of him. Like the energy they bring to that interaction with him is so strange. And I mean, he's always getting picked on. He's always getting othered. So this is just more of that. Mm-hmm. But I'm like, why are you guys, would you just be a jerk to anybody like that?
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I wonder if I guess it probably ties into the idea of, you know, Christmas being people not honoring the true spirit of Christmas, right? Like they're really just about appearances and putting up like pretense. So
that's a really good point.
You know, they go to church and they're like, okay, I've done my Christmas Eve duty. I'm done. Oh, now I can revert to being the jerk that I am and make fun of this guy in a Santa Claus suit.
I think you're right. I think that's it. Wild.
So Harry then parks his van and he is beckoned by the sound of a band playing Santa Claus Comes Tonight. So, of course, this is like music to his ears. Oh, that's not even a pun. That's just terrible. But he follows it to a very different kind of Christmas party than his work event. And he's kind of looking in, like dancing along outside, bopping his head. And some partygoers see him out in the street and they drag him into the party. And Harry's first instinct is to reach for something in his bag, presumably a weapon, before he realizes he's being invited in. They're actually like, hey, come in, have a good time with us.
Yeah. They're like, we're having a Christmas party. You're Santa. Come on in, Santa. And like, I'm wondering if maybe they had hired a Santa and they just thought it was him. Because he starts handing out presents to kids and nobody questions it. The other thing that I couldn't quite get my head around is like, what time of day are we at? Like, I thought we were at midnight mass, but now we're a Christmas party with children, like young kids, up late. And maybe that's just how this town parties. I don't know. Have a great time, I guess. But like, that's it adds to the strange quality of this movie of sort of feeling like, it's always Christmas. It's never not Christmas. It doesn't matter what time it is, as long as it's Christmas. Because he keeps going from one event to the other without any sort of like passage of time, you know?
That's very true. Yeah, because like we start at night at the Christmas party, like his work Christmas party. And then all this other stuff happens and it's still night and these kids are out. And I mean, yeah, maybe this is a town that is just like, we're going to stay up late. The kids will sleep in. We'll all get to sleep in on Christmas Day. And this, I think this part is where you really, I mean, you feel sorry for Harry through the whole movie. But I think here you see him and he is enjoying the party. He's having a good time. He's dancing. He's giving out gifts, as you said. He's laughing. But it's spliced with detectives arriving at the church.
Yeah.
And investigating. And he leaves the party. We see him urging on his reindeer as he drives the van to Frank's house. So like, I feel like this is where his mental break is complete. He's like, I'm good as Santa. Like people like me as Santa. So I'm going to like lean into this further because you actually see him like, he's like pretending to like, not whip the reindeer. That's terrible.
But like to drive them.
Drive them. Thank you. That's what I was looking for. and you hear the sleigh bells ringing and like, it's very much like leaning full on into this fantasy.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think he's dissociating from what happened at the church, what he did at the church.
Yeah.
Because he went from that awful experience as Santa to like a perfect magical experience as Santa. And he's like, oh, I'll just stay here in this energy.
Exactly. So he drives the van to Frank's house and he climbs onto the roof and attempts to go down the chimney. Before realizing that it's not going to happen, he has to kind of pry himself out of the chimney. And we're covering Gremlins for the other other Halloween, other Christmas episode this year. And that's all I kept thinking about was like Phoebe Cates' dad dying in the chimney.
Me too. Like this part is pretty scary. Mm-hmm. Like it's tense. And the first time I saw this movie, I was like, is this where it ends? Because I had remembered hearing like, oh, the ending's very crazy. And so I was like, does it end with him just being dead in the chimney in a Santa suit? Like, is this a prequel to Gremlins? But it doesn't. He pulls himself out.
Yeah. He then manages to get into the house through a ground floor window and is spotted by Frank's two children as he's putting presents under the tree. But then he sneaks into the master bedroom, where he wishes Frank a Merry Christmas as Frank wakes up and he places the sack of toys over his face, smothering him. And then when that takes too long, he slashes his throat with a Christmas tree star.
Yep. It's very strange. Like, because I was sort of scared for the kids in the house. Mm-hmm. Like, even though he hasn't showed any harm to kids other than giving a bag of dirt, like, I was scared for these kids because we've seen him kill people now at this point, and we figure he went to this house to cause harm, but he's putting presents under the tree and he just sort of shooes the kids off to bed.
Mm-hmm.
And then he does this very weird, like, Christmassy Santa, like, he murders Frank as Santa, you know? And I'm just like, what is going on with this person? Like, he is fully off the rails at this point.
Mm-hmm. Oh, he totally is. And then you get that scene where, like, he's leaving and the kids see him again.
Yeah.
And you're like, these kids are going to be going to therapy for the rest of their lives.
Well, and I think it's an excellent callback to the beginning of the film, because as you and I both agreed and we laughed about it, like, he really overreacts to his initial.
Yeah.
I want to use the word trauma, because it seems like it was traumatic for him. But I also don't want to use the word trauma because it seems like a really normal thing happened. Mm-hmm. He learned Santa Claus wasn't real. He saw his parents making out. Like,
yep.
That could happen to kids all the time. And mm-hmm. so, like, or not all the time, but you know what I mean. So, yeah. Like, it just seems like a normal childhood occurrence that really messed up the trajectory of his life, versus now these kids have actually, like, experienced horrible death in the family on Christmas. Like, these are the kids who would make sense for them to go have a Christmas slasher movie years later. It makes more sense for them than it does for Harry.
Yeah, exactly. Christmas Evil 2.
Yeah, seriously.
Frank's Revenge. Frank Jr. It's Christmas morning. Harry goes back to the factory and he, like, sabotages it. He breaks all the toys. So Christmas Day, Phil's worried that Harry isn't there because he's always there on Christmas. And Phil and his wife are arguing about Harry. And we see a news report about the Christmas Eve murders. And viewers are advised, don't approach anyone dressed as Santa. And we see that history just might repeat itself because Harry's nephews are arguing over the existence of Santa because one has told the other that Santa doesn't exist.
Mm-hmm.
And it's at this point that the police bring in a lineup of Santas as Harry's trashing the factory. And then he calls Phil and says, I've found my tune and I'm going to play it.
Yeah, which, okay, that line. Had we heard that line earlier in the film and I just missed it?
He said something to the executive at the Christmas party about, like, about people not knowing there's a tune, but you guys are worse because you know there's a tune and you don't, like, you just don't use it properly or something like that.
It's like this line made me feel like that he has a whole internal world that we're not privy to. And I'm not sure if we're not supposed to know what that line means and just feel sort of strange about it.
Mm-hmm.
Or if maybe a scene was cut that explains what that means, because it's like I can kind of figure out what he means, but also, like, it's a little bit of a stretch. Like,
yeah,
I assume the tune is like his purpose.
Yeah,
and he's
obsessed with Christmas music, so maybe, yeah, like, that's, yeah, yeah,
yeah. So, like, maybe I don't know. Maybe he got a pep talk at one point telling him his purpose was, like, finding the perfect Christmas song. I don't know, because we don't have any kind of explanation in the film. So it just is very, very strange and alarming.
Yeah.
When he says to his brother, like, I have found the perfect tune. I got kind of scared for what I was like, what does that mean he's going to do?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So after he talks to Phil, he gets his van stuck in the snow and Harry runs into a group of children and their parents. And the kids are super excited to see Santa, but the parents are freaked out. One of them pulls a knife as the kids huddle around Harry. And the kids do what they can to protect Santa. Like, they are like, they're that line. You're not crossing this line. You're not going to hurt Santa. But a kerfuffle ensues. Young Angelina, this cute little blonde girl, grabs the knife that her dad has dropped and hands it to Harry. She chooses sides pretty clearly. So Harry, like, kind of lunges at them, but then he starts to run away. And one of the adults, this little lady, slashes at Harry with her festive corsage and, like, cuts his face. and an angry mob forms, complete with torches, very, very Frankenstein-ish. Mm-hmm. So Harry runs back to his van, manages to drive it away, and heads to Phil's house.
And I didn't think of this until you just said, much like Frankenstein, but that little girl, Angelina, who takes sides with him, kind of reminds me of like the girl who gives Frankenstein a flower, or Frankenstein's monster a flower. Don't come for me, Twitter. I said Frankenstein's monster. But it's like, you know, this, like, children being able to see through the monstrosity to the goodness of something, like, especially if that's what they were going for, trying to make this a monster movie. I can definitely see the parallel to Frankenstein there. But also something that really distracted me during this scene is, like, what kind of a knife is that to carry? That's not a knife that you carry. Like, I come from a part of the country where, like, there's a lot of hunting. And, like, I know a lot of people who, like, carry hunting knives. It's, like, not weird where I come from. That is not a knife that you carry. Like, why did he have that knife on him? We need to investigate that dad.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding.
Walking around with a blade that big. You need to have a permit for that. I don't know.
Yeah. That's a good point. What has Angelina's dad been doing?
I don't know. And maybe there's a reason she picks sides.
Maybe.
He's throwing knives all over the place. At that point, Santa seems quite gentle. These are the things I thought about watching this movie.
So Phil at this point realizes that Harry is the murderous Santa. And Harry blames Phil, saying, I wanted to prove to you that there was a Santa Claus. So Phil starts to choke Harry and lets go when he loses consciousness before dragging him outside as his sons watch from an upstairs window. Like, these poor kids. Like, there are so many kids in this movie that are going to need so much therapy.
Yeah.
All because Harry found out that Santa wasn't real and saw his mom making out with his dad. Like,
right. Like, let's get over it, guys.
Yeah. Perspective, Harry. Perspective. Yeah.
Perspective.
He stuffs Harry back into the van where Harry regains consciousness and punches Phil in the face as he wakes up. So Harry, beaten up, bloody and bruised, he drives away and is intercepted by the mob and he drives off of a bridge. Now, normally you would think the van would crash, but instead it flies into the sky like Santa's sleigh. The full moon bright in the night sky as we hear a voiceover say, what I heard him exclaim as he drove out of sight, Merry Christmas to all and to all a good night. And that's the movie.
It is. And it leaves you going, what?
Yeah. All right. So let's talk about that ending first for a second.
Yes, please.
So what do you think happens?
So I think he dies. I think that his van crashes, but it's sort of like, you know, the last thing that he sort of hallucinates before he dies is being like riding Santa's sleigh into the sky, because he's painted that sleigh to the side of his van, and like he's clearly been thinking he's driving these reindeer. So driving off a bridge, why wouldn't he be able to fly like Santa? Mm-hmm. So I think he probably dies in a pretty horrific crash, but I think he maybe died doing what he loved.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's his voice in the voiceover, right? That's
it. Like, I thought so. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's kind of what, like, I assumed as well. Like, I think it's the whole movie is really Harry progressing to this point where he just completely dissociates from who he really is and thinks that he's Santa and thinking that he has this magical ability to fly his vehicle pulled by his invisible reindeer up into the sky like Santa does. So.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me a little bit of, like, I haven't seen Ernest Saves Christmas in a long time, but isn't there a scene like that in Ernest Saves Christmas? Or am I conflating that with some other movie?
I don't remember if there's a scene. It's also been a very long time since I saw that.
Maybe I'm confusing it with the scene in National Lampoon where, like, there's like
an explosion.
Yeah, the explosion that sends all the reindeer in the sleigh up to silhouette against the moon. Maybe that's what I'm thinking of. It evoked a a silliness to me that reminded me of silliness in another movie, which I don't think is how they wanted you to feel at the end. I think it was meant to be, you know, quite tragic and touching. And honestly, talking through this with you has made me appreciate Harry's story so much more. But like, the feeling you get at the end of the movie is such like a, what the hell is happening? And then it ends and you're just kind of like, what did I watch?
Yeah. Yeah. It's a bizarre ending for sure.
It is.
But I don't know. I kind of like it. Like I will definitely say that the first time I saw it, I got that silliness factor that you talked about. But I feel like the more that I've seen it, the more that I become like, oh God, that's so sad that like he thinks this is a good thing.
And it is quite sad.
And it's just tragic. Yeah.
Yeah. Like you could make a version of this movie that really pulls the heartstrings.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, what are some of your favorite scenes in the movie?
Definitely the eye gouge at the church. Because I figured something was going to happen at that point. Like I figured we were going to get some sort of action, but I didn't really anticipate it being that. And it took its time. Like it showed you the violence in a very 80s way. So I really liked that about it. I also really liked the Christmas party that he attends as Santa that he's invited into. Like, I think that whole scene is just really sweet. And it's also a little bit scary because you kind of wonder, like, what else is going to happen because that's right after the church scene. Mm-hmm. And I also really liked the hospital drop-off for a similar reason because it's kind of a – it's not a fake-out, but you worry something bad's going to happen and then it doesn't. And you're like, oh, this is kind of nice. Mm-hmm. So – two nice scenes and then an eye stab.
Yeah, those are my favorite scenes as well. Like particularly like the scene at the children's hospital, you think it's going to go badly and that security guard is going to get killed, but it completely doesn't. And you see the joy that he brings and he is really embodying the spirit of Santa and Christmas at that moment. And it's very rare in any kind of horror movie that you would see the villain. I mean, even when it's a sympathetic villain, you rarely see the villain portrayed as a hero. And I feel like he has a couple of those moments. And one of them is at the hospital. One of them is the Christmas party that you talked about. But also the Christmas party is just this idealized version of how he wants Christmas to be because it's warm, it's fuzzy, everybody's inviting, and then you contrast it to his work Christmas party, which is really just joyless and dull. And I feel like that's illustrated so much at the beginning where, like, first of all, their boss can't even show up to the party. Like, he's just going to be on video and deliver this message about their charity scheme. But also, like, at the very beginning, they're just showing people pouring drinks because, like, that's how you're going to get through this work Christmas party is just to be as loaded as you possibly can be.
Relatable.
Right? Exactly. Whereas the other Christmas party, everybody's happy. They're dancing. It's full of laughter and joy. And it's just lovely. And then, but it also takes that weird little twist at the end where he says to the kids, you know, like, you have to be good because if you're bad, I'm going to bring you something horrible. And the look on the kids' faces like changes and then he laughs and they all start laughing. But there's that one woman who looks super uncomfortable and she's standing there like, this isn't normal. Like,
I forgot about that, but you're right. That was weird.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a very weird scene. And I think it's just like because he sees everything in black and white, he just really like you're good or you're bad. And and even like, you know, his lists aren't like he's got his naughty and nice lists and they're very distinct and you're on one or the other. And I think he starts to look for things like I'm sure Moss Garcia did good things, but he didn't add them to the nice list because he's like, you've already done all these other bad things. So
that's true. It's not like he had like a, you know, here's the number of good things and bad things you've done, and here's your average for the year. It was just like, you're here or you're there, and there was no changing lists.
Mm-hmm. I also realized that I would make the naughty list because it includes things like exaggerates freely, talks back, uses profane language, gets up late every day.
I was like, come on, give us a break.
Yeah, exactly. Best scare. I know we talked about it. It's not like a typically scary movie, but was there anything that scared you or like, you know, you would classify as a best scare?
Yeah. So it's kind of two answers. So like traditional horror movie, maybe slasher movie answer would be the eye stab, just because it is sort of abrupt. But as we were talking through everything, I realized how unsettled I felt by the, I can't even remember it exactly, but like the, I found my tune.
Yes.
And you're going to hear it. Like that line was so unsettling. And it's sort of like, it reminded me of when you hear a person talk in their sleep and they say something that almost makes sense and you go, wait, what? Like it reminded me of that, except he's fully awake and trying to make a point. So like, that's sort of deeply scary.
Yeah, that's a good one. That is a good one. It's very unsettling. You're right. And because he's just so insistent and he's so like, what's the word I'm looking for? Adamant, I guess, in his, like in his beliefs. But for me, it was Frank's death. And I think, even though I think the eye gouge was more shocking, I think it was the whole like build up to Frank's death and then like the whole like aftermath. Because you see, like, first of all, imagine waking up and seeing one of your coworkers standing over you dressed in a Santa suit.
Nope.
Right. And then like he has this hurt, like he tries to smother him with this sack of toys, and then when that doesn't work, he grabs this Christmas star and like just slashes his neck, and then he falls back on his wife's body, and when she's trying to scream but literally can't get any sound out other than
that
feeble gasps.
Horrible. Yeah, I kept waiting for her to scream. And she does, she's too shocked. I was like, holy crap, that's really real.
Yes, yes. And then he goes out and the kids see him and he's sweaty. Like he's like very, like he's obviously drained from trying to smother Frank. Yeah. And then their mother starts screaming. Oh my gosh, that whole scene is, to me, like the most scary part in the whole movie.
Yeah, I totally see that. That is like from top to bottom scary in every way, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about the emotional impact, because I've said already that like I feel like it's heartbreaking because Harry is a killer, but you really sympathize with him. Did you feel that way?
I feel that way now. I think especially going into this movie the first time thinking it was going to be something else and like it being a part of like a show and drinking and then like watching it again. Yeah. For this podcast, trying to reset my expectations, like I feel like I couldn't quite get my head around it. But having talked through it now, I really do feel like this is a heartbreaking story about like family and expectations and like pressure and traditions and just like watching out for your loved ones who might need you or might need something, you know?
That's a really good point, because even like his sister-in-law says that. To Phil, she's like, he needs you. Like, he needs you to look out for him. And even though, you know, you're the younger brother, you need to be there for him.
Like, did anybody just ever ask Harry, like, hey, man, how you doing? You okay? How's work? You know? Not that that excuses his behavior. I don't want to, like, play into that idea at all. But it is just a really heartbreaking story of a person who clearly wasn't okay, was going through a lot and like had a mental break.
And he thinks he's giving people what they want. And I think he says that to Phil at the end. He's like, I was giving the people, I thought I was giving the people what they wanted. They thought they wanted Santa Claus, but they didn't. And like this movie, this might be a bit of a reach, but this movie also kind of reminds me a little bit of Charlie Brown's Christmas.
Because I can see it. Yeah.
Charlie Brown just wants to get back to the heart of the holiday, right? He wants to go back to the pure, like, essence of Christmas. And I feel like that's what Harry wants. And luckily, Charlie Brown, as far as we know, doesn't turn out to be a murderer, but
as far as we know,
as far as we know.
No, I think that's a really good point. And I think like this movie, Christmas Evil, maybe the name isn't just a random grab bag. Like maybe it's really exposing the potential horror in a traditional Christmas. And I'm not like a Christmas hater, but if you break it down, Santa is very, very creepy and weird. Like, he comes into your house without asking. He eats your food. He leaves you stuff. You're supposed to be appreciative. He's watching you all year.
All the time.
He's got a bunch of people working for him. Like, it's creepy, right? And, like, or it could be framed that way. And, like, a lot of the traditional stuff about Christmas that we frame as magical could be framed as very horrific. And so maybe calling this movie Christmas Evil is, like, the evil that Christmas can be. That's also a reach, but I'm standing by it.
No, I think that makes sense. And even, like, it's funny that you say that about, you know, like, Santa being creepy. So when I was younger, I have three brothers, one older and two younger. And the one that's the youngest right after me, was terrified of Santa, and not so much of Santa. He was terrified to sleep alone in his room on Christmas Eve because he thought if Santa can get into the house on Christmas Eve, then anybody can get into the house on Christmas Eve.
Oh.
And so he would always sleep in my room with me. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like, I'm like, you know, the biggest scaredy cat there is, but okay. And it became a tradition where like my two younger brothers would always sleep in my room with me, and we'd make this big like event out of it on Christmas Eve. But that's a really good point that, like, you know, Santa is kind of creepy when you break it down like that. You could also say
that's very sweet about you and your brothers. Yeah.
You could also say like it's the evil in everybody else around him at Christmas. Like it's the evil of the yuppies coming out of church, who should be filled with, you know, goodwill towards men, and then come out and like mock this guy on the street. So
that's true.
Maybe Christmas Evil was the perfect name for it then.
Maybe.
All right. Any other thoughts you want to share before we get into a body count and rating?
Just that I've really come around on this movie talking through it.
I love that. It's so funny when that happens. Like I've had that before. So I'll use a recent example. I was not a fan of Halloween Ends.
Okay.
I watched it with two friends who were also not fans. But then as I started to read more about it and hear other people talk about it on Twitter specifically, I was like, I'm kind of warming up to it. And now I'm like, I need to watch it again because I feel like I will take away a completely different experience than I did the first time I watched it. So sometimes just talking through something like really like, I don't know, changes your perspective on movies or books or whatever. So.
That's the beauty of having a community around horror, is being able to talk through it and read other people's stuff and go, oh, I didn't think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And especially when it's like it's awesome when it's a movie that you already love, but when it's something that you maybe don't necessarily love or even something that you don't like, I think I like that even more where I'm like,
yeah,
somebody's opinion literally just like changed my whole perspective on this. So
it's nice when that can happen. It reminds me that I can change my mind about stuff, which is a great reminder.
Yes, absolutely. All right. So body count, I think, was four. We had three people at the church and we had Frank, and I don't think anybody else died.
I think you're right. That's a very low body count.
It is a very low body count. Mm-hmm. So I think we can officially say this is not a slasher.
I think that is safe to say, yes.
All right, so how many scaredy cat screams would you give this on a scale of 1 through 5?
You know, on Letterboxd I gave it a 2.5, but I think I'm gonna bump it up to 3. I give it 3 screams. Nice. Yeah, just because I have really enjoyed talking through it.
3 is a solid, respectable rating. I know some people get very upset by 3s, but I'm like, a 3 means that I liked it.
Yeah, 3 out of 5 is like I would watch again.
Yeah, exactly. Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on today. It was a lot of fun.
Oh, thank you. I had a ton of fun.
So tell us where we can find you.
Yes, so you can find me on Twitter at @Ari_Hellraiser for as long as Twitter is around. And you can find me on Letterboxd at the same name. And if Twitter doesn't end up working out so good for us in the future, I'll probably jump to Instagram under the same handle.
Well, you can catch us on Twitter at Cat Scaredy and on Instagram at Scaredy Cats the Podcast. We are also on Hive now as at Scaredy Cats the Podcast. So you can subscribe wherever you find podcasts. Don't forget to let us know what you think by leaving us a review. And until next time, stay scared.